This is part three of Here Comes the Judge. Part three of Here Comes the Judge. I'm finding this a fascinating study and a presentation to all of us to look with new eyes at the book of Daniel. For we find in the very last chapter of the book an insistence that the prophecies of this book should be sealed up until the last days, the latter days. And in sealing something up, that means it has to have a revealing at some point in time. So many prophecies in the book of Daniel have been fulfilled. There are things yet to be fulfilled, but in that fulfillment progress or process, we are struck with how thorough God is and how involved He is in bringing about His plan. Just as a reminder, when we started out talking about the book of Daniel, we described the fact that Daniel's name, Hebrew name, means something. It means God judges, or God is my judge. Now that's interesting all by itself. However, the 4 points I gave you starting out were that the book was written for the last days, number one. Number two, it shows God's great power and plan. Now there are other books of the Bible and other sections of the Bible that show that as well, but you are struck in the presentation of the book of Daniel that God has tremendous power and He has an insurmountable plan. No human government can thwart it. No powers of the dark world can allay it. It will be fulfilled. Number three, it shows that God cannot be contained by human limitations. We'll find in the statement made in today's presentation that Nebuchadnezzar felt that there was something that this God could not do. In other words, he put a limitation on God, but we find from this book that God cannot be limited. And number four, it is the classic battle between good and evil. The classic battle. It's of the stuff of which Westerns are made. You know, the black hats, the white hats, and all of those good things. Good versus evil. Riding off into the sunset. You know, Roy Rogers and Trigger. Or Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, whichever, you know, I don't know which one he was closest to. If he hadn't died first, I don't think he would have stuffed Dale. But he did stuff Trigger, and Trigger is still out there in the desert, Appleby Farms or something like that. So we're going to now continue our examination today to look at the book of Daniel. In chapter 2, just as a reminder again, bringing us up to date since we've been to the feast and perhaps need a little bit of recollection. At the end of the chapter, after Daniel has revealed the prophecy, not just revealed what it meant, but had revealed it because the king did not recount the prophecy. He said he forgot. And he asked all of his soothsayers and his wise men and all of those folk to tell him the dream as well as the interpretation, and none of them could do it. But Daniel could. After Daniel had made the presentation, which of course tickled the fancy of Nebuchadnezzar, after all, it was a dream about a head of gold and a chest and arms of silver and a torso of silver and the legs of brass and the feet of iron and clay mixed together. And the head, Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar, is you, O king. A head of gold. Oh, yeah, of course, why not? I guess I should have known that. It pricked his intellect, it pricked his vanity, his ego. But he was impressed with Daniel because Daniel recounted something that was astounding. Here's what Nebuchadnezzar said as we end chapter 2, verse 47. Surely your God is a God of gods, and Lord of kings, and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery. Note something about this. This is a limited description of the power of this God of Daniel's. He doesn't say he's all powerful, that he can do anything. He can reveal these mysteries, and for that I acclaim and acknowledge your God, Daniel, as being the God of gods. Like, I've got gods, Nebuchadnezzar says. His favorite god was Nabu. That's why his name is Nebuchadnezzar. Nabu was one of their gods. His grandson, Belshazzar, was named Belshazzar because Bel was another god. He was the bull god. They had gods everywhere. So by saying your God, Daniel, is the God of gods, it is not a full acquiescence to the power of God, the Elohim or Yahweh. Not by any means. Because if that were true, the whole rest of the story would be different. But it is not. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect or governor of the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel, in verse 49, Daniel does not forget his friends. And this is a beautiful notation. One should never forget from where you've come. Never forget it. Some people try to live it down, don't want to remember, but we should remember from whence we've come. And especially those who helped us along the way. Remember, in the first chapter, Daniel and the Hebrew boys were in league together, not in a conspiracy, but in an agreement that they would live a certain lifestyle. They would conduct themselves in a certain way, and they gained strength from one another in accomplishing that decision. So when Daniel was elevated by Nebuchadnezzar, he made a request to the king in verse 49, and the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. Now that's a pretty high situation, to be sure, to be elevated. And why were they elevated? Because Daniel had told the mystery of a dream. Just that simple. On top of it, let us note that they were committed to purpose and perfection, the Hebrew boys. They were not simply there for performance or false pride. Let's look and learn in chapter 1. Just again, we're setting the table for what is to follow in chapter 3. They learned the language. Look at verse 5 in chapter 1. King appointed them a daily ration. They also, it was appointed to them that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. These were young men who had been taken captive from Jerusalem, Judeans, or they were of the Jewish faith and Jewish lineage and so forth. So here they are, after 3 years, after they learned the language. You have to learn the language, because if you speak Hebrew, you got to communicate in Babylonian. So for 3 years, they were in this educational process. Not only were they to learn the language, and in verse 17, they had to become familiar with the ways of the Babylonians. Look at verse 17. And as for these four youths, Daniel, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. What literature? The Hebrew literature? They already knew that. What literature did they learn? The Babylonian literature. In other words, they learned the ways of the Babylonians. Not that they participated in the ways of the Babylonians, but they learned about it. They were wise in the way the ways of the Babylonians. Now, in verses 8 through 9, they also learn to recognize the chain of authority. Verses 8 and 9, Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choicest food or with the wine which he drank, so he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. This is a problem many times when you get into the issues of what goes on in school, right? What goes on in society. I don't want my children participating in, well, what's coming up? Well, Halloween. And so we go to the teachers and we do things like this. Now look, I don't want my children participating in that pagan stuff. And you won the teacher over real fast, of course, with that approach. Now, it says here, Daniel, in this hostile environment, made a request. Now, you can make a request with sugar, or you can make a request with vinegar. What gets the best result? I think we were all taught we can catch more flies with honey than you can with vinegar, is it? Or some other foul-tasting thing. Here's an example of how Daniel recognized there was an authority thing here. And if he was going to be in favor, he had to take the right approach. Daniel understood that. So, in verse 9, now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. When you use the right approach, God grants you favor. And that is one of the fine points to be extracted from the book of Daniel as we move along. Here they were in a hostile environment, a pagan environment, a foreign environment, an environment that was destined to crumble, this Babylonian empire. But they were elevated, Daniel and the Hebrew boys, to leadership in that environment. The first step was, of course, the king coming to recognize their great wisdom and great tact and so forth, as chapter 1 tells us, but also the ability that Daniel had to give witness to a mystery, a dream, and give the interpretation thereof. So one would ask the question, how can one excel in a captive, degenerate environment? How can one do that? Because that's the place where we live. Oh, it's all around us. And we know it to be true. But how can one excel? Look at Psalm 137. Because this question and this psalm was written not at the time of David, but after David. Why do I know this? Well, look at the context of what the psalm is saying. Psalm 137, by the rivers of Babylon. Where is Daniel and the Hebrew boys and Ezekiel and a whole host of other folk by the rivers of Babylon? They are captive there. There we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion, Jerusalem. Upon the walls in the midst of it we hung our harps. For there our captors demanded of us songs and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us a song of Zion. I couldn't help, since there's a series running on PBS right now entitled Africans in America, I couldn't help but think about the time of slavery when the master would command of the slave, sing, dance, show us how happy you are. And the slave, for longevity and for perseverance and to get a little better treatment, would feign or pretend to be happy. And so the notion was, boy, they sure are happy people with those chains. Nobody in servitude is happy. We go back to the ancient Israelites when they were in Egypt and recognize that the cry for freedom reached up to heaven. And God had to respond to extricate them from such a situation. So it should not be mysterious to us that even as Daniel and the Hebrew boys were being elevated, they still were captive in the land of Babylon. And so these words ring true. The question then is, how can one excel in captivity in this degenerate environment? The fact of the matter is, some can't. Look at verse 4. How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? And then we learn something from verses 5 and 6 that some can. And I imagine that this part of the psalm is something that Daniel and the Hebrew boys would be quite adept at doing. It says, If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget her skill. May my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. I remind you that contemporary with Daniel and the Hebrew boys are Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra and Nehemiah come back from that captivity by the waters of Babylon, because we read in the book of Nehemiah, don't we, that Nehemiah was troubled by the decay that had come to Jerusalem. And so they had not forgotten. And Nehemiah, of course, was the king's cupbearer to Artaxerxes, and therefore was in a powerful position. They learned how to excel in captivity. But God blessed and honored them to bring them back, because they did not forget the Lord, and they did not forget Jerusalem. And that particular passage in Psalm 137 has an application to answer the question, how does one excel in the midst of chaos, in the midst of captivity, in the midst of an environment that is hostile to one? Now, with such favor, as we go back to Daniel now in the third chapter, with such favor enjoyed by the Hebrew boys, how could they fall out of the pleasure of Nebuchadnezzar? How in the world could that happen? Can you see it? Here's Daniel. Daniel, you're great, and your God is great. Whoever that is, look at this mystery that you have revealed. Nebuchadnezzar is saying, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you gifts. I'm going to exalt you. I'm going to place you in command of the Babylonian province. And Daniel says, cool, if I may use the colloquial term. I'm down with that. I appreciate that. But my buddies over here, part of my crew, my posse, I want them to have some acknowledgement too. Oh, that's all right with me, Nebuchadnezzar says. You want your buddies to come along with you? Fine. But chapter 3 changes the whole story. And it reveals something about Nebuchadnezzar that is not in evidence yet. That he is not anywhere near, quote, conversion. Not anywhere near truly acquiescing to this God of Daniel, the judge. Let's consider chapter 3. What it shows, of course, is that you can never predict what a carnal, unconverted mind will do. You just can't predict it, except to know that the carnal mind is against God. But you never know how low it will go. And even after we have examined history and have experienced things ourselves, there comes sometime along the way in life a recognition that I never thought that would happen. I never heard about that. I never believed that could go down, because you cannot predict what the carnal mind will do. In chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar makes an image. Now, some people erroneously suggest that this was an image of himself. Not so. Couldn't have been. The proportions are all wrong. Let's consider these proportions as we look at chapter 3. Chapter 3 says that he creates this image in verse 1. An image of gold, a height of which was 60 cubits, and its width 6 cubits. Now, right away you know that this is an awful thin image of himself. Let's translate it into our modern usage. A cubit has been determined to be 18 inches. So, if we multiply 60 times 18 inches, we come up with 1,080. Not inches, but cubits. You'd multiply 18 inches into this 1,080, you come up with 90 feet. You translate 12 into the figure 1080. 12 inches, you're going to break it down into our modern usage, right? You get an idea that this statue or this image is 90 feet tall. And you do the same thing with the 6 cubits, you recognize that it is only 9 feet wide. What could fit that kind of image? an obelisk, you know, like the Washington Monument. That's about the way you would look at it. Something tall and slender and something thin that Nebuchadnezzar had erected. And he required, and there may have been an image of Baal, B-E-L, one of their gods on it. You know, Baal was a big-time god. Belshazzar, his grandson. Belteshazzar, Daniel's Babylonian name. Baal was a big god in those days, and he was a bull god. And so that may have been one of the images on this image that had been created by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, where does that come from? You would think, having dealt with Daniel's God, that he might consider something a little more in keeping with this revelation that he has had, that Daniel's God is a pretty tough guy, if I may use the term guy. So, Nebuchadnezzar is not quite convinced of this God of Daniel yet. He builds this image. We have described then down through verse 7 what was supposed to happen. It says, when certain sounds are made, he gave this command in verse 4, to you command and give this to the people, O peoples, nations, men in every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, and the lyre, and the trigon, I'm reading from the New American Standard Translation, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you all are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. Now, you know the tradition of the Jews. When they practice what the Ten Commandments say, it is not possible for them to bow down in such a situation. It's impossible. And those who adhere to the precepts of the commandments that say you should not bow down to any graven image of any kind, this is setting up a real dichotomy, a real problem in their situation. So Daniel and the Hebrew boys, but primarily the spotlight has fallen on the Hebrew boys here in this instance. They are put into a situation. This is probably, as I said, not an image of himself, Nebuchadnezzar, but an obelisk and an image that has this perhaps god, a golden god on it, Baal. And as this situation emerges, verse 8 tells us, for this reason of that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. Remember the question? How is it that these young men would fall into such a situation, having been elevated so high? There are three things that can bring a person down. Jealousy. Jealousy is a very powerful tool of wreaking havoc on people. What about pride? Oh yeah, pride will do it too. And also revenge. And when these three things are wed together, you find that somebody is going to be in trouble. In verse 8, we find that the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, or the Chaldeans were a class of the Babylonian Empire people, brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. You yourself made a decree, and you said, blah de blah de blah de blah de blah de da de da. They went through and rehearsed everything that the king had said. And verse 12 says, now there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province. In other words, you made a mistake. You elevated these Jews to very prominent positions. And they are not appreciative of it. Not like we Chaldeans would have been if you had appointed us to these positions, you see. But you appointed these Jews, and these Jews are not following your rules. You said that everybody, when you hear this music, bow down to this image that you erected. And they are not doing it. And we are jealous about it, and we do have a certain pride. I mean, that we have to be acquiescent and obedient to some Jews who we caught and put into servitude. Yeah, we don't like that, but they're not saying all of that, but that's all part of the mix. And we would like some revenge. Verse 12 continues by saying, and naming them, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. And so the stage is now set. The boys from the hood, I'll just call them that for a modern terminology, the boys from the neighborhood of Jerusalem, they've got a problem. They have now to respond to the king who gets, it says in verse 14, verse 13 describes it, he's in a rage, he's angry. He ordered to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to him. And he asked them, is it true what has been proclaimed about you, that you have not served my gods or worshiped the golden image that I have set up? He could have also said, well, you know, I acknowledge this God of Daniel, which is your God, and you all are buddies and so forth. Why can't you acknowledge mine? It should not be such a problem. I mean, I'm big-hearted. I've acknowledged your God as being, you know, a pretty good God. He reveals a lot of mysteries, but I'm just telling you, you guys are really messed up. Here's their response. And it's a response that comes out of their recognition that there comes a time when you must make a clear and unmistakable stand for God, no matter the cost. Why? Because God is judging, and his judgment alone counts. Here's what they say in verse 16. O Nebuchadnezzar, we need not give you an answer concerning this. We don't have to study long and study wrong. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. Now that's a mouthful. We don't want to pass over that too quickly. Nebuchadnezzar is the king of the entire Babylonian Empire. He has conquered everything in sight. There is no one who can stand up to his power and his ability. And so, to say to him that our God is more powerful than you, Nebuchadnezzar, because he can deliver us from your hand. Well, really? Nebuchadnezzar is thinking. We'll see about that. But they go on to say in verse 18, but even if he does not, that's a hard thing to say sometimes, isn't it? Even if he does not. It does not mean that he can't. It means merely that he has chosen not to. And to come to understand that is a part of the Christian journey of being involved with God and with Jesus Christ, to recognize that sometimes his will is so perfect, we have to get in harmony with it. And that will may be that God does not move to do the thing that we want done. But it should not change our faith. It should not change our focus in the fact that God can. Even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, in verse 18, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. We're not doing it. Now, jealousy and pride and revenge and even a little part of what Nebuchadnezzar may have had, a little sense that he was being put down, it says he was filled with wrath in verse 19, and his facial expression was altered towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I guess at one time he kind of liked them. They're Daniel's buddies. But he changes his whole visage because of what has happened here. And he gives an order in verse 19 that the furnace should be hotter, seven times hotter than it usually is. Now, a furnace that is designed to burn up people is hot enough. But he wants it hotter. He wants to make the point that I am tough and I am bad and you can't do anything about it. In fact, it says he commanded certain valiant warriors in verse 20 to cast them into the fire. These men in verse 21 tied up their trousers, their coats, and their caps with their other clothes and were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. That's the three Hebrew boys. Verse 22, notice this. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace had been made extremely hot, The flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's hot. Anybody been around an open flame or a furnace know the heat that comes out of it. Anybody worked in a steel mill, and I've always been appreciative of people who work in those environments because it is hot. There used to be one I walked by in Detroit when I was a young lad, and it was hot outside the window that you looked into to see these guys working. So you know what it was like inside with those hot bars of metal, red hot, in some cases white hot. And this is what the three Hebrew boys are confronting. I find it interesting. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, in verse 3, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. Now, I don't know about you, but that would be quite a witness to me. And it was a witness to Nebuchadnezzar, too. But before we get there, understand that there are furnaces of fire on a physical plane. But jealousy, pride, and vengeance are heat-creating devices, too, that can cause one to erupt into flames. And from this, we should learn that if we don't control our passions, our jealousies, and our pride, and our vengeance, we can succumb to the heat. Think about it. Even innocent people are hurt in the process. The ones who Nebuchadnezzar commanded to take these lads up to the fiery furnace, they died. They were innocent. Because of the vengeance and the anger and the wrath that Nebuchadnezzar possessed at this moment. But verse 24 turns the story for us. But God, the righteous judge, can and will deliver. Nebuchadnezzar, in verse 24, it's described here, he was astounded and stood up in haste. I mean, he got up in a hurry. He's watched his soldiers who carried up the Hebrew boys die. It says the flames killed him. That means the flames must have been coming out of the furnace. Or at least the heat was so overbearing that it killed them. And yet the Hebrew boys fell into the furnace, hands still tied. You would think maybe the hands would have been untied by the flame. And here's what he says, this great king of the Babylonian Empire. Was it not three men we cast bound into the midst of the fire? And all the people standing around observed, said, yeah, king, certainly, O king, we agree. He answered and said and looked, and this, in the King James translation, you have an unfortunate translation, a mistranslation, where it says the Son of God. The Hebrew expression is Bar Elohim, not Elohim, Elohim, E-L-A-H-I-N. It does not mean Son of God. It means sons, Son of Gods, Son of the Gods. Because remember, this is a pagan environment that had a lot of ideas about gods and angels and mysterious figures and so forth. He said, Nebuchadnezzar said as he looked in, I see four men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. You have to check that out for yourself. They had knowledge of angels. Notice verse 28 to underscore this. After they have been extricated, Nebuchadnezzar says in the starting down, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel. The God of these three boys have sent his angel. So this was a being in the fire with the three Hebrew boys that Nebuchadnezzar clearly saw. Caused him to rethink his position, to rethink what he was all about. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar, in getting in a hurry to see what he was seeing, came closer to conversion. Not quite there. He's got to go through something in the fourth chapter before he comes to truly acknowledge this great God, the judge. But right now, through the mechanism of the three Hebrew boys who gave a tremendous display of their commitment to God and his way, we find them in verse 26. Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of blazing fire. He responded and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire, and all of the people and the rulers standing around gathered around and saw in regard to these men that the fire had no effect on their bodies, nothing on their hair, their head was not singed, nor their trousers damaged, not even a smell of the fire. I don't know about you and whether or not this is a significant witness to you of the power of God or not. But it's here for us in the book of Daniel for our consideration that if we are put in harm's way, if we are found to be surrounded by enemies and flames of fire, God is able to bring us through it. And sometimes we will be put to the test on whether or not we believe that, just as the Hebrew boys were put to the test. What of all the other Hebrews who ate the fine food of the king's table, who went along with everything, who not only learned the ways of the Babylonians, but became a part of Babylon? But not these kids, not these young men, not Daniel. So when Nebuchadnezzar proclaims in verse 28 that we have mentioned that God has sent an angel, delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's commands and yielding up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God, that impressed Nebuchadnezzar. Oh, he was impressed. Here's what he says in verse 29. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, get it here, in any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. You say, wow, Nebuchadnezzar, man, that's pretty close to being converted. But not quite. Notice the qualifier back when he speaks to Daniel in chapter 2, the end of chapter 2. He says, your God is a God who reveals mysteries. That's all that your God can do. He's good at doing that. Now he's confronted with the God of the Hebrew boys, and he says, well, there's no God who can deliver in this way. But what about some other way? He's left the door kind of open, you see. He's not quite there yet. If this were a consequential moment in the life of Nebuchadnezzar, this great king of the Babylonian Empire, then his reaction would be different, as we will find when we go through chapter 4, and God takes him through 7 years of insanity. God is not through dealing with this great king. And if God takes time dealing with such a man in that day, is there any ruler in the world today to which God is limited in his dealings? I say no. And sometimes he deals with them in ways unknown to us, because we have described here God's dealings with the Babylonian Empire, with Nebuchadnezzar the great king. Is there a nation on the world, face of the world, greater than America today? And would he not have the possibility of dealing at the highest echelons of the American government if he so chooses? Sometimes we limit God and think that he is only active in the pages of the Bible, when in fact the whole book, and this book in particular, tells us that God is not limited by any of that. It says in verse 30, then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. I say to you that God is using this book to reinvigorate in our minds that He is the judge, that He is God, and that besides Him there is no other. Next time we will take a look at the fourth chapter when the king has a dream and Daniel interprets it, and the result of the dream is that this Nebuchadnezzar is brought down to the banks of insanity and grovels around in the dust for 7 years eating grass like a cow. And when he comes out of it, he comes to recognize what the theme of the book is, that God is judge. And I hope that we take time to study ahead and consider the fact that God is judge not only in ancient times, but He is judge today.